Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the winter of 2009, Congress passed President Obama's $825 billion stimulus package called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It was the largest economic recovery plan in U.S. history. President Obama described it as a short-term plan to create jobs and a long-term plan to spur economic growth. Economists and nonpartisan forecasting firms estimate that the stimulus created and saved between 2 to 3 million jobs. The money was spent on everything from roads and bridges to job training programs and schools. But most of the package was invisible. More than half went to tax cuts for the middle class, and we'll talk about the politics behind that. And some of the spending just doesn't make sense. Millions went to airports that get very little traffic, while airports that need repair didn't get a dime. So how was the money doled out, and how should we make sense of the stimulus? Did it work? Who benefited from the biggest ever government injection of cash into the economy? Today's guest, Michael Graybell, traveled to 15 states to find out if the U.S. reversed its long industrial and middle class decline. He wanted to get out of D.C. and follow the money. And he writes about his findings in his new book, Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 trillion Stimulus, the biggest economic recovery plan in history. Michael Graybell is an investigative reporter with ProPublica. That's an award-winning independent nonprofit newsroom that produces investigative journalism. And he joins us from Washington. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you. You know, the one thing, major thing that stuck out for me in reading your book, one page is just full of words like schools, homes, bridges, roads. You basically describe where the money went. And what stuck out for me is that the administration did a poor job of really explaining to the public what this did. Why are so few of these programs, publicized?
Well, the administration early on spent a lot of time talking about infrastructure. They said this was, you know, they're talking about shovel-ready projects that could start, at the drop of a hat, and, you know, within months of passing the bill. And so that created the impression that this was going to be largely this public work package, workers going out to the Midwest and trying to, you know, with sledgehammers over their shoulder, this sort of New Deal image to repair our roads. And the truth was that very little of the money actually went there, and they spent very little time talking about the tax cuts and the school and the teachers' jobs who would be saved until about 2010, 2011, when the re-election was happening.
You report that they went on 400 trips to attend groundbreakings, announce funding, and promote the stimulus, and yet the Republicans won the soundbite war in many ways.
Right. The administration had a really, you know, they had this sort of shovel-ready, what was sort of the term they were using, and it really hurt them when for 6 months nobody really saw any infrastructure projects starting. There was the famous case, and minutes after the bill passed, the politicians in Tuscumbia, Missouri, all met on the side of a river to have a sort of a makeshift council meeting to approve this bridge. And you saw sparks fly the minute after President Obama signed the bill in Denver. However, most of the projects were not like that, and were like a bridge out near in Pennsylvania, where they had to delay the project because the school bus routes depended on that bridge. There were others where they had to delay because of the winter construction season, got too cold to do the project, so they had to wait for steel shipments until the spring of 2010. So this was, you know, a year after the bill had passed, many projects hadn't even begun.
And again, this was the largest economic recovery plan in U.S. history. We're talking $825 billion. You report it's nearly five times more expensive than the Works Progress Administration, WPA. It costs more than the Iraq War from 2003 to 2010, bigger than the Louisiana Purchase. So talk about the importance of really focusing on just how big the stimulus really was.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, the WPA, the Moon Race, the Manhattan Project, all of these major programs in history that we learned about in high school and in our textbooks, the stimulus program added up, you know, was bigger than all of these things. But it's been harder. I think it's harder to define, at least the impact and the legacy has been harder to define than those programs, because the money was spread so far and wide, you know, was spread so far and wide to all these different programs. It was almost as if Congress was trying to make the stimulus bill a cure-all for all of the ills that America has faced over the last 30 years, whether it be our rail system or our education system or, you know, research for cancer or money to stop guns from crossing the Mexican border into the U.S. I mean, all of these things that you wouldn't traditionally think of as stimulus got into the bill.
Right, and that's why it was criticized by so many people, and we'll talk about that later in the show. But a good way to kind of grasp it is to look at the three different parts. So just quickly talk about the three parts of this bill.
Sure. The bill was really broken up, you know, I'd say four different parts.
Okay.
First, this flow of money in tax cuts and in safety net spending that the hope was it would get people spending again, consumer spending again. And then we saw this huge influx of education and healthcare money that was meant to stop the bleeding in state budgets. Everyone was facing these huge deficits. And then these shovel-ready infrastructure projects would kick in. We'd have these new jobs, repaving roads and making homes more energy efficient. And then the last part was, as you mentioned at the start of the show, these long-term investments in things like high-speed rail, clean energy, electric cars, broadband, things that the president and the administration and the American people hope would lead the country out of the recession and into this 21st century economy on a strong new foundation.
And out of those four parts, which one got the most money?
Tax cuts.
So
the safety net spending was about $500 billion in the $800 billion bill.
So let's talk a little bit about the tax cuts. It's really interesting to read about what went on behind the scenes and the politics involved in these tax cuts. So these were tax cuts that went mainly to the middle class, $116 billion tax credit. And what was so interesting about this is I remember when George W. Bush, and I'm sure our listeners remember this, when they gave out checks, they made such a big deal out of these checks. That's all they talked about. Talk about how the administration handled checks in this stimulus.
The administration went a different way. They kind of looked at what President Bush had done and decided that most people, and there was research supporting this, that most people had saved their checks, and that the way to get people to spend was to have them not notice it. And the way to have them not notice it was to just sort of change the withholding levels in the in your paycheck. So you would get maybe $10 more a week, $20 if you got paid biweekly, and your check would increase, but you wouldn't really know why. And that if people doing it that way, it would just feel like an increase in your income rather than a bonus. And so that was, I think, the intention. The problem was it wasn't very substantial. We were talking, you know, $10 a week. So it wasn't large enough to counteract these large prevailing things that were happening in the economy with people losing a job, a lot of people losing their home or knowing someone who had lost their home or was on the verge of it. And then the impact of the stock market, where people had just seen their 401ks almost cut in half, their retirement savings. So $10, $20 a week wasn't going to do anything to counteract that. So in losing, the fact that nobody really saw a third of the stimulus bill, they also lost the thing that Bush benefited from, was just the positive attention that a tax check got. People, you know, when that happened, people were literally waiting in the mail to get their checks. I remember I was a reporter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and they sent me down to the mall to go ask people what they were going to do with their checks.
Right.
But they got, you know, a story out of it. I mean, it was, so there's that they lost too.
Yeah, it was really a brilliant PR campaign because I remember people laughing about how much attention the administration placed on this check, but they got so much media out of it. So what were the politics behind this? Why would they decide to put $10 a week in a paycheck that most people who are struggling to make ends meet probably would not notice?
Well, I think one of the first things about it was that it originally was going to be much more than this $10 a week, you know, $400 a year. That part of the bill got chopped down in negotiations to make room for some of the other things that the compromise senators, you know, the Republicans, if they needed to vote for it, would accept or wanted in the bill. One of those was the alternative minimum tax patch. The alternative minimum tax is this thing that upper middle class or middle class Americans have to pay in order to make sure they pay a certain amount of tax. But it's not tied to inflation, so every year more and more middle class families get caught up in this and have to pay this tax that's much higher than they can afford. And so in the stimulus bill, they put about $80 billion into that, and this is something that Congress on both sides of the aisle typically support and pass at some point during the year. $80 billion, you know, took up 10% of the stimulus bill when it could have been used. It literally was taken away from these tax checks, the Making Work Pay Tax Credit, and it was taken away from money that would have been given to the states to patch up the state education budgets and prevent more layoffs of teachers.
And then also on these tax cuts, you report that the president offered the tax cuts at the outset instead of having Republicans demand them. So he didn't wait back and say, okay, we'll go with these tax cuts, but first you have to come to the table and say you want them. So why did he do that? Because you report that by doing that, he really gave up a critical bargaining chip that might have made the stimulus seem like a more bipartisan effort.
Right. I interviewed Senator Dick Durbin for the book, and this was part, in a section where I talked to him. He says, you know, this is one of probably the biggest flaw of the stimulus package, this sort of poor bargaining chip that was floated out really at the beginning in hopes of getting Republican support that could have been saved for later in the process as a compromise. They were compromising from the beginning in hopes of gaining goodwill, but it didn't work out. One of the reasons it didn't work out was because despite this this concept or this bargaining chip offered by the president, the rest of the bill had been largely written by Democratic leaders in Congress without the participation of Republicans. So they were already somewhat miffed about this, and the tax cuts, you know, just sort of got swept into this idea of they're not playing fair with us, and we're just going to oppose the bill then.
We're speaking with Michael Graybell. He's an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and he's out with a new book called Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, The Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. And Michael went to 15 states to take a look at the projects and to find out how the money was spent. Was it spent well? What was wasted? What was spent on projects that really didn't make much sense? He wanted to get out of D.C. and take a look on the ground in different states across the country. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about the largest stimulus plan in U.S. history? And if you, your community, received any of this money, what changes have you seen? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how the Democrats dealt with this tax cut and this $10 a week increase in checks. Did you notice it? Did you even know that you were getting $10 a week? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And you can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. What else can you tell us, Michael, about what went on behind the scenes? It was really interesting just to read about the politics and the conversations that went on with President Obama's economic team. In fact, there was a pretty heated debate over how much the stimulus should be. And some people wanted it to be over a trillion, but they didn't want to use that word trillion.
Right. Dr. Christina Romer, who is head of the Council of Economic Advisors, had done some some economic studies. They essentially had dispatched her and some other folks on the economic transition team early on to run these models and see what would happen with different size stimulus packages. And one of the highest she ran was this $1.2 trillion stimulus idea. And she looked at it and said, if we really want to bring back the economy to its full amount, it needs to be at this $1.2 trillion stimulus level. So the more political side of, the political advisors on the transition team thought that that was a little bit would never make it in Congress. And then Larry Summers, who's head of the, who's the president's chief economic advisor, was also thought this was kind of a naive thing. And so that there was a little bit of internal censoring. They had run these other models in one of these economic meetings. Christina Romer had gotten the economic team to go up to $800 billion. She thought that was somewhat of an achievement. However, this $1.2 trillion number was internally censored, not necessarily by Larry Summers, who's been pointed as, in some depiction of this as the person who is against this. But Dr. Romer herself was somewhat wanting to censor this and not look naive as a new person in Washington. She hadn't served as much as the other folks who had been in the Clinton administration. So there was an effort not to come into a meeting before the president and say $1 trillion and look like you didn't know what you were talking about. So they came to this final decision that they would offer about $750 billion to Congress, 775, I believe the number was, and that Congress would do what it always does, increase the size of bills up to about $900 billion. It didn't actually happen like that. They ended up keeping it pretty close to that number that they originally had, which was lower than the administration had hoped would happen.
And at the end of the day, who was really in charge of doling out the money? What was that process like? Because what I love about your book is you explain all of these projects in small towns or places where they had airport upgrades, even though maybe there's one plane that arrives daily.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing to read about all of this. So how did this get doled out?
Everybody doled it out, essentially. So the money came from the federal agencies, and some of them were funded through formulas. So everybody got an amount of money based on how many highway miles they had in their state or some sort of figure that had nothing to do with the recession, which is one of the reasons why it was hard to target the money to the places that needed it most, whether it be the Midwest manufacturing cities or the places in the Sun Belt that were hit by the housing bust.
Well, we've got a couple of callers on the line, so let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes. Good morning. I'd like to know what portion of the stimulus funds went towards high tech and with what results, and also what portion went to the military and the defense contractors, and also how that was spent, and if there were any egregious examples of poor spending, if there's any ways in which you feel it was well spent.
Thank you, Harry.
Well, I guess it somewhat depends on what you mean by high tech. There was about $7 billion in the bill for broadband funding to bring it to rural areas and to install public computer centers in inner cities. And then there was this large portion, it was about $80 billion that went to clean energy, and a certain percentage of that could be considered clean tech. On the defense side, most of the defense money was not to the fighter jets or contracts like that. It was to making military bases more energy efficient or doing construction projects that need to be done on military bases. There was some Homeland Security money. The body scanners that we now have in airports were largely, and some of the X-ray machines were largely funded by this increase in stimulus money. So there were some elements of that in there that could be considered, defense Homeland Security contracting.
And also, just to highlight how this money was doled out, you have a great example when you're talking about home weatherization. And you write, the best example of this was the five, well, actually, you write that these government programs had skeleton crews, and then all of a sudden they were flushed with money. You write, the best example of this was the $5 billion weatherization program in which contractors would insulate low-income homes, caulking leaky windows and replacing energy-sapping appliances. This represented a dramatic increase from the program's annual budget. The administration set a goal of weatherizing 1 million homes a year, seven times the number of homes done normally. States saw their budgets go up 10, 20, even 60 times. On top of that was a dispersive funding mechanism in which money would flow from the federal government to a state agency, to a community nonprofit, to a local contractor. I mean, this, I think, just speaks volumes about how money is doled out. And we don't really talk about that much in this country.
Right. It's a sort of decentralized system that really slows things down. Weatherization was this perfect example. Before the weatherization program really took effect, it was described as a low-hanging fruit of the clean energy movement. And Secretary Stephen Chu actually said that this was fruit on the ground. That's how easy it could be done. But they did not anticipate this model. I mean, they must have known about it, but they didn't anticipate how much this would slow things down, that you had almost four layers before anybody could actually get hired. At the same time, there was a new requirement that had never been applied to weatherization funding, which was that workers would be paid prevailing wage. This is standard in government, but it had never been applied to weatherization. So during the stimulus bill, when they were trying to get money out and get people hired, they were spending about almost a year trying to figure out what the prevailing wage was to calculate it in every county in the U.S. So that really slowed things down. And then the other aspect was that these agencies that were going to be dealing with the money were very poorly staffed. There's a example I use in the book about Michigan, where almost all of the houses that were going to be weatherized had to go before the Historic Preservation Board. However, the folks who dealt with these historic preservation reviews, there was only two people in the office at the time dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of new applications that had to be reviewed.
And also, Harry wanted to know, can you talk a little bit more about other maybe wasteful projects? What really stood out for you? And there was an inspector general who looked at this. Do we have any sense of actually how much was wasted?
The problem with this is that waste is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
And things will seem wasteful on the surface that turn out to be worthwhile when you dig into them. The things that I've written about in the book prominently are, I can't remember the exact amount, but a substantial amount of money went to purchase costumes for these mascots like Bobber the Water Safety Dog. And to explain, Bobber the Water Safety Dog is essentially a stuffed animal kind of thing you would see a mascot for a college team, for example, but promoting water safety to kids, which sounds like a good idea. I'm told that the kids enjoy it. The costumes were made in the U.S., but you have to look at this in comparison to that money could have been spent on a bridge, could have been spent, there were factories at the time that were closing, that were laying off hundreds of employees at the time. So it's all relative in
right.
terms of this waste issue. We can get into this later, but an area where money is no longer with us was the Solyndra project, which I write about a lot in the book.
Right.
Go inside the factory.
Yeah, and we will talk about that after the break. What's funny about, I shouldn't laugh, but the people who opposed the stimulus grasped onto things like the costumes, the turtle
right.
tunnels. In fact, the Wall Street Journal had an interesting review of your book. They gave you kudos for uncovering this information, but they solely focused on the waste, and they were shocked that you didn't say this was a complete failure. So we're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Michael Graybell. He's an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and he wanted to find out how the largest stimulus in U.S. history was spent. He traveled to 15 states. We'll also talk to him about his travels and what he found on the ground. He writes about his findings in his new book, Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus. Actually, it's Money Well Spent with a question mark. The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, the biggest economic recovery plan in history. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about how this money was spent, if you live in an area where it was spent, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255 or yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this. profiting from the...
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. If you or someone close to you has been a victim of domestic violence, please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 when the topic will be domestic violence and getting restraining orders against abusers. My guests will be family law attorney Emberly Cross of the Cooperative Restraining Order Clinic in San Francisco and retired Santa Clara County Superior Court Judge Eugene Hyman. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about who's making money off of the war on drugs. We are talking about $1 billion a year, $15 billion to be specific, in 2010. So who's making money off of all of the money spent on the war on drugs? And then Thursday, we'll have a conversation about the new documentary Invisible War. It's about rape in the military, and it opens in theaters this weekend. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're speaking with Michael Graybell. He's an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and he's out with a new book called Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 trillion Stimulus, The Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. And if you have any questions about how the money was spent, what was spent well, what was wasted, when you're talking about $850 billion, how do you think that kind of money should be spent? What did you think about the tax cut? Did you notice the $10 increase in your weekly check? And if your area received any money, what was the end result? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also post a comment at yourcallradio.org so others can see it, or you can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have an email from a listener, Michael, and they say, your guest was making comparisons on the amount of the stimulus package with things like the WPA. But what is the comparison in the same present-day dollars? And why do people like Robert Reich and maybe Joe Stiglitz say that the problem with the stimulus was that the portion going to ordinary people and meaningful jobs and projects was not large enough?
The numbers that I gave out before were in the adjusted for inflation. So in comparing dollars to dollars, the stimulus was five times bigger than the WPA and was much bigger than the Manhattan Project, the Moon Race, the Marshall Plan, all those things. So economists often talk about, on the left especially, you hear that the stimulus wasn't large enough, and that was its sole flaw. And while there's some possibility there, one of the things I think people have to realize is this was not an option in February of 2009. If they wanted to get President Obama did not come in with 100 Democrats. They had 58, I believe, at the time, or 59. I had the more precise number in my book, but I shouldn't say it on the radio. For fear I'd be wrong, they had to get several Republicans to vote for the bill, and the problem was that in order to get a larger stimulus in the end, the question is, could they have gotten a larger stimulus by having a better design package? Could they have gotten a larger more stimulus in the fall of 2009 when there was still large concerns about unemployment and when there was would have been some will for it? What happened was that there were a lot of disputes within the economic team about how to promote more stimulus while also offering something on the deficit, which was believed to be a greater concern at the time than it has shown to be. And there was also this countervailing bill of, we've done the stimulus, now we need to focus on health care. So one person told me that everyone was focused on health care at the time, and no matter how many times we went around debating what to do about economic policy within the economic team, it wasn't ever going to be proposed by the president because we were so focused on health care.
And so you say that we might not see anything like this in our lifetimes again.
Yes. I mean, you see what we have now, where there's really no appetite for spending of something this large. Any sort of large bill, whether it be clean energy, people say we've tried that already. Now that we've gotten to the point of even disaster spending, you remember with Hurricane Irene, this idea of spending money to help people who have been devastated by storms is now controversial, where we need to make sure we offset it before we help anybody. So the tide has really changed from an idea where Congress can pass large historic bills to a more divisive setting, at least for the time being.
All right. Well, thank you again for the email. And let's go to our next caller, William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I would appreciate the author's perspective on this perspective that I'm going to offer. I would opine that the failure of the stimulus, to the degree to which it failed, was probably not due as much to the issues that he's describing as to this world economic fact. When the stimulus, which was represented in the 1930s by the WPA, etc., took place, it stimulated the economy because the first workers who received the money then spent it on products made by other workers who were in the United States. And therefore, that's what the stimulus is. The purpose is not just to build a bridge, it's to stimulate the economy because the money circulates within the economy. However, at the present time, with the current purchase patterns, it is most likely that the first workers who received the money then went and did stimulate the economy, but the economy they stimulated was probably located in China. Mm. Because that's where I only use that as one example.
Right.
It could be anywhere where products are produced at low wages. And therefore, I think that one could have seen in advance that unless somehow the purchases were restricted by the first workers or by the companies to products that were made in the United States, there was no hope to stimulate the economy. There would have been problems with that approach, which we won't get into right now, but I'm sorry that aspect has been overlooked.
Thank you. It's a great point, William. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
Well, I think there is some truth to that. They do look at that when they come up with the economic models. For example, with the tax cuts, one of the reasons that people think tax cuts are not as effective, or some economists think tax cuts are not as effective, is number one, that they're saved, but number two, that when you get $500, a lot of people do spend it on a TV, which primarily is not made in the U.S., or other electronic kind of products. So there is some truth to that.
And also, what the point that William raises, you can apply that to so much of what the presidential candidates, President Obama, talks about stimulating the economy. We got to get people spending. We often look at how much people spend in retail or consumer spending indexes every month. But the point that William makes is very rarely brought up.
Yeah, that's true. There's been somewhat of an acceptance that people, that it's okay that we don't make things in the U.S. because if we were to put any restrictions on them being made overseas, then companies that do sell things overseas would face the consequences of that in terms of tariffs or other trade policies.
And then the idea behind these tax cuts, the administration was able to say that the tax cuts would stimulate the economy because they went to the middle class and not the wealthy? Was that the idea behind it?
You mean
well, because
for that $100 billion?
Right, because the narrative is that tax cuts create jobs, right? We've heard this for, 10 years? And the Bush tax cuts, based on the data, did not do that. And so was the Obama administration able to make that argument because they didn't go to the wealthy, they went to the middle class?
Well, it would have gone the other difference between the tax cut from the Obama administration and the Bush administration, these stimulus checks, is that they were scaled further down to the middle class and lower middle class, whereas the Bush administration tax cuts had this restriction that you actually had to pay tax, I believe, to get money back. I may be not giving all the nuance there, but the Obama administration really said that it didn't matter if you didn't, that you didn't pay taxes because you were too poor to really have to owe any taxes. Everybody would get this tax credit in some way of this money, and the only limits would be on how much salary you made on the higher end of the scale. So the idea was that the idea behind this was that lower income families were more likely to spend it and not save it because they have greater necessities that need to be dealt with right away. This is the issue with food stamps, that, and in those cases, the money generally goes back into the American economy for food production in our local grocery stores.
Right. And do we know the total package for the tax cut? Robert writes in and says, even had workers received their tax cut at once, the total benefit would have been $400 for individuals and $800 per family, not enough to make a single mortgage or rent payment for most households. How much did individuals and families get at the end of the day?
So on this, specifically on the tax cut issue, if you didn't go over the maximum income, it was $400 per year per person, so $800 per family.
Okay.
Now, people may have benefited in other ways, whether they, if they did get a job, if they took advantage of the home buyer's tax credit, if they bought a new car. You know, there was various other sorts of things that they could have benefited from.
And how many years?
For the tax cut?
Right.
Tax cut. It was 2 years for making work pay, and then we've had additional tax cuts through the Social Security, a drop in the Social Security withholding. Since then.
Okay, so we're talking for this stimulus, $800 total for individuals and $1,600 total for families.
Over 2 years.
Right. Because it was $400 a year.
Right, if you have a husband and a wife in this situation.
Right. Wow, that's not that much. Well, thank you. That I'm glad you brought that up, Robert, because it really kind of brings it all together. Thanks for emailing. And we're talking today with Michael Graybell. He's a reporter with ProPublica and author of the new book, Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the $1 trillion Stimulus, the Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. And Michael traveled to 15 states to find out how the money was spent. He wanted to leave the D.C. bubble and find out on the ground what projects were actually started, how the money was spent, what was wasted. Of course, that's in the eye of the beholder. What you might think is wasted, someone else might not think is wasted. And if you have any questions about how the money was spent, if it was spent in your area, we'd love to hear from you. We've got about 15 minutes left. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Craig in Santa Cruz. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good morning. Rose mentioned a little bit ago about an inspector general, and my question was about oversight. Was there any congressional oversight, like along the lines of the Truman Committee during World War II, that looked at specific spending and efficiency, anything like that?
So there was not a specific congressional panel set up, but there was this thing created called the Recovery Accountability and Transparency Board, which everyone quickly called the RAT Board. And the RAT Board's job was to sort of monitor spending as it was happening in hopes of preventing fraud. And there are some cases where they did this. The other thing that you might note of, there's this website called recovery.gov where every contractor recipient who received money had to file a report with the government telling taxpayers how they spent the tax money. And this was somewhat, in terms of government transparency, this was actually somewhat revolutionary that people who get taxpayer money have to tell taxpayers what they did with it. You can go online and read these reports, and they are some of them are more detailed than others. The congressional oversight we're seeing now is, you know, we saw very little when the Democrats were in charge of it. Now we see hearing after hearing after hearing in the House Oversight Committee now that the House is controlled by Republicans. So there has been some valuable stuff that has come out, you know, in terms of what we learned about Solyndra. Some of it could get, you know, does receive criticism that is driven by politics. The number of times we've had some of the hearings about clean energy, but a lot of the things that we know about Solyndra are solely because Republicans have been able to get copies of emails and copies of memos that were written.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And we'll talk about Solyndra in a minute. But first, I want to talk about your travels through Elkhart, Indiana. You report that with an unemployment rate that had quadrupled to just over 20% since the recession began, by March 2009, Elkhart had lost jobs faster than any other county in the country. The New York Times called it the, quote, white hot center of the meltdown. A British tabloid labeled it Joblessville. And the president made his first trip to launch the Recovery Act at town hall meetings there and tried to put a face on the dire statistics. I love stories about these small towns. You write that it's home of the largest maker of high school band instruments in the U.S. For many years, it was where Alka-Seltzer was made. Its largest industry started when Wilbur Schulte saw a trailer display at the 33 Chicago World's Fair and, with an entrepreneurial gumption that residents say typifies the town, started selling trailers outside his father's clothing store. And so Elkhart became the Detroit of the motorhome industry, the RV capital of the world. What did Elkhart look like when you drove through it?
Elkhart was devastated by the recession. And when I went there in early 2009, you could really see this. There were signs all over town, literally signs, where, you know, the mechanic shop said, you know, Elkhart, let us help 10 to 15% off repairs. Salvation Army, we have new mattresses. Hopman Jewelers, buying old jewelry. And, you know, the residents I talked to were talking about the story in nearby South Bend about a woman who robbed a Long John Silver's fast food restaurant, apologizing as she was doing it, you know, if I wasn't down and out, I wouldn't be doing this. And there was a flea market in town that had this shirt that said, I want a bailout for me. So there was a lot of anger as well as frustration, as well as just people out of jobs. I remember I went. I was driving through town and came across this sign where somebody had posted on their lawn, bailouts don't work. Family with 9 children put out, foreclosed on. And I went and talked to this family that had 9 kids, Terry and Desiree Gunyon, and they had been hit, had essentially got a double whammy. They had seen the success of the home repair. The husband was a drywall contractor, so he is making a lot of money during the housing boom. And then all of a sudden it dried up for him. And he, at the same time, with all, things going well, had bought a house that when things weren't going well, he couldn't afford. So they ended up moving with 9 kids into, you know, renting a trailer where kids were living in a walk-in closet because that was the only space they had if they didn't want to be in a homeless shelter.
And do you know how they're doing today?
So today they've... They moved out of the trailer. They have moved back into a rental house, but his drywall contract business has essentially dried up and remains that way. For stability, both he and his wife have gotten jobs at the local Walmart, where they have, I don't believe, been able successfully to get on from part time to full time yet.
Like a lot of Walmart workers.
But despite that, Walmart has become the stability that from the construction business.
Well, that's the case in so many towns, right? Because if you drive through a small town and the downtown is sort of decimated, full of cobwebs, broken glass, you can bet that there's a Walmart within about 2 miles of the old downtown that basically no longer functions. And then a lot of people have no choice but to either work there or the fast food joint, and Walmart often does not hire full time, so then they don't have to give benefits. Did you find that in your travels?
I found a lot of people who were going back into these employment situations that were not what they remembered. Mm-hmm. Another guy in Elkhart I talked to, Ed Neufeld, who worked 36 years for the RV business, really embodied this story that Obama talks about President Obama talks about in Audacity of Hope, you know, the middle-class Americans who can get a manufacturing job almost out of high school and build a middle-class life. He ended up losing his job and working 3 part-time jobs that did not pay what his old manufacturing job paid. And the friends who did get jobs back at the RV plants were going back making almost half of what they were when they were at the plant.
What did this experience do for you as a D.C. reporter? I often feel like a lot of the politicians live in bubbles. Some of the reporters live in bubbles. What was this like for you to actually meet people who are directly affected by policies, but these are the people that we don't really hear from or see on a regular basis in the media? What was that like for you, and how does that affect your reporting today?
Well, this to me is the most important thing. I mean, putting the going out and seeing how these policies really affect people. Nobody really cares about the debates over a bill. They want to know how it's going to affect their real life, and they want to know why Congress isn't doing more for them. And so a lot of my reporting since then, you know, on economic issues has been going to be more and more focused on what this means for people and going up from the ground rather than hearing it from Congress.
And were the stories similar as you drove through 15 states, people really struggling to get by and taking jobs that really aren't paying a living wage?
There was a lot of that. I mean, I did. So I'll talk about one area I went where there was a lot of stimulus activity, and this was in Aiken, South Carolina, a really rural area in near the Georgia border, where they have an old Cold War nuclear plant that made a lot of plutonium for the space program and for our buildup of nuclear weapons during the Cold War, and they had a lot to clean up. So almost overnight, 3,000 employees, I believe, were hired at this plant. And I spoke to, you know, the city manager, the city leader, the Chamber of Commerce, and they were talking about how great this was that all of a sudden all the hotels and apartments were filled up, that the hotel taxes had returned higher to the level than before the recession. Mm-hmm. So in a small area, they really did see the impact that stimulus can bring. And what was interesting was that this was a very Republican region. McCain won hands down in 2008, and they had not one, but two very active Tea Parties that competed for the ability to protest in the center of town during the 2010 elections.
Yeah, you have a lot of colorful stories about some of the people you meet and their politics. What about your experiences in Silicon Valley and doing reporting about Solyndra? How much of what we heard in the media really matched what you saw on the ground and what didn't?
Well, I think, you know, the thing that's interesting about Solyndra is less about the politics. I mean, I think people have tried to make this was simply a political flavor, and it's a lot more complicated than that. The real damaging thing about Solyndra was that at the time of the investment, you know, early on it was very exciting. They had this new product that was really going to transform the solar industry. But by the time they actually got the final commitment on the loan, it was clear that silicon prices were dropping. And the whole reason that Solyndra's product was going to be successful was based on the idea that silicon prices would remain high and they would need this alternative type of solar panel to do it. What was really interesting to me is that I compared it to what was happening at the NUMMI plant out there, where 4,700 workers lost their jobs at this auto plant that was a joint venture between Toyota and General Motors. And what was really remarkable to me was this was the NUMMI plant, if you remember, in the early 1980s, was promoted as this idea of how U.S. could lead in could remain a leader in manufacturing by adopting the sort of efficient models that were being promoted in Japan. And as the stimulus was kicking in, this plant collapsed, and all the workers lost their jobs. And the hope was going to be Solyndra that would lead in manufacturing in Fremont, California, the same exact city just down the street. And again, we saw what happened, where in this case, I believe it was reported 1,100, but now we learn it's been 1,700 employees, I believe, who've lost their jobs through the Solyndra collapse.
And also, do you have any updates on the NUMMI factory and those workers? I haven't read much about that lately.
I don't have anything greatly new, but the this one guy I spoke with who I read about in the book, Mario Mendez, who worked there for many years, he had been struggling, and I think he remains to be struggling to find a job, looking all over the place, including back. He used to work in plastic injection molding and couldn't find a job at his old types of employers. But when I went to the Solyndra factory, the plant was completely automated. It was so automated that they had robots who would go along a magnetic guideway in the floor, carrying parts of solar panels from one part of the assembly line to another. And this is essentially what Mario Mendez did at the auto plant. He brought parts to an assembly line. So these robots that, by the way, played Disney music or Christmas tunes because they were so quiet and it was the only way that people would know they were coming, were also going to be going away in the new factory. The new factory funded by the stimulus was going to be even more automated, and these robots were going to be losing their jobs. So for people at NUMMI like Mario Mendez, they were now two generations behind the automated changes that were happening.
Well, and this raises a question, and I'm going to ask you to project a bit here, Michael, based on the research you've done, the traveling you've done, and then the behind-the-scenes what went on behind the scenes with the politics, the economic team, for example. Where do you think we're going from here? Because you've got robots. I mean, even at the Foxconn factory, they said, all right, young workers, if you raise your fists and you ask for raises, we're going to replace you with robots. And then there was a great piece in the Washington Post by Harold Meyerson talking about how jobs that used to pay $50 an hour, for example, in Detroit are now paying maybe $25 an hour. There's a new factory, Caterpillar factory in Muncie, Indiana. Very highly skilled jobs that pay between $12 and $15 an hour with no benefits. So where do you see us going, just say in the next couple of years, when it comes to job creation and economic growth?
I've always been warned not to predict the future.
But just sort of based on the trends you're seeing, do you think the unemployment rate is going to stay where it is, or how do you see that playing out?
Well, I mean, one thing that we're seeing a trend of is these jobs that are coming back are not coming back at high wages.
Right.
A lot of the jobs that are coming back are less than they were, have fewer benefits than they were, or in some sort of, we have this contingent economy where people are now contract employees or temp workers. And we're seeing more and more of that. The unemployment rate, I mean, no one can really guess as to which way it's heading. Right now, it appears not to be going the direction we want it to. One of the problems is that we don't have any long-term policies in Congress. For the last few years, has been unable to put any certainty into the economy with bills like that.
Exactly, and that's my question, is if we're not going to have another stimulus this size, what does that mean for the economy?
Well, I mean, the other problem that I was mentioning there is this lack of certainty, not, number one, as to where the economy is heading, but to what our energy policy is,
right,
which we haven't come to agreement, what the healthcare bill is really going to mean, what our tax structure is going to be. I mean, we've been talking about that and the deficit reform for 2 or 3 years, and it's really, I think, caused people to not really know for sure how, which way to go and which way the policies are going.
Right. Well, there's so much to talk about, and I just really enjoyed your book. You have really great on-the-ground stories. Michael Grable is a reporter with ProPublica, author of Money Well Spent, The Truth Behind the Trillion-Dollar Stimulus, the Biggest Economic Recovery Plan in History. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Who's profiting from the war on drugs? On the next Shore Call, we'll talk about the money behind the drug war. The U.S. government spent over $15 billion in 2010. So how is that money spent? Investigative reporter Lee Fang argues that powerful lobbyists for the prison guard unions and the beer and alcohol industries spend heavily to maintain the status quo. So what do you want to know about the money spent on the war on drugs? It's Shore Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for your call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Up next here on Local Public Radio, the world have your say from the BBC, and following that at noon, Philosophy Talk with John Perry and Ken Taylor. The San Francisco Frontrunners are holding their 33rd annual Pride Run this Saturday, June the 23rd in Golden Gate Park. The events include 10K and 5K runs starting at 9 a.m. near the soccer and polo fields. There's also a short, fun run for kids. Information on signing up for running or volunteering and more can be found online at sfpriderun.org. sfpriderun.org. The time is 11 o'clock, and this is 91.7 KALW San Francisco, local public radio online, kalw.org.
Hi, Ros Atkins. Welcome to the BBC's World Have Your Say, live from London.
This crisis was not originated in Europe. This crisis was originated in North America. But we are not putting the blame on our partners. What we are saying is, let's work together when we have a problem.
Lots of talk at the G20 in Mexico about what caused the global economic slowdown, but most of you are more concerned that no one seems to know how to fix it. Head south to Rio and you'll find thousands of frustrated activists who once again feel that the world's politicians are not addressing the threat to our environment. But as many of you criticise our leaders for failing to cut deals that make a difference, isn't the issue here that you're expecting too much? Can politics really offer us solutions when it requires its practitioners to think short-term to get re-elected?